I had been adjutant for just over a year when disturbances broke out in Zululand, which ended in declaration of war against Cetshwayo and the Zulu nation. Officers for special service as well as troops were being dispatched from home, and as I had spent the most of my youth, 7 years in Natal, and had a very fair knowledge of the Kaffir language, it occurred to me that I should stand a very good chance of getting out if I put in an application. It was an opportunity not to be lost. Having received my orders, I went up to London to do my shopping, going straight to Messrs. Silver & Co., where I got everything I required, except boots. While making my purchases, I noticed a gentleman following me very closely, and presently he asked me if I was going to South Africa, as I seemed to be selecting the very things suitable for a campaign. He said he was also going out, and as he was at a loss to know what was best to take, would I allow him to accompany me and make similar purchases. So I gave him my list of things to copy. He, Lieutenant Courtney of the 21st Hussars, and I subsequently went out together in the Edinburgh Castle. On the 11th of January, the 3rd Column crossed the Buffalo into Zululand. The artillery in the 24th Regiment went over by degrees in the pontoon, a little above the main drift, known as Rorke's Drift, after the Dutchman Jim Rorke. The men were formed up in quarter column on the hillside, and one or two officers on their ponies were sent out in different directions to try and find in the dense fog where any of the other troops were and what was going on. While this was in progress, old Inga Bangi, the witch doctor, asked permission to address the men. Never shall I forget his extraordinary elocutionary power and the splendid oration he delivered. He would have gone on much longer had we not received orders to move. Without stopping to take breath, he recounted the history of the Zulu nation, which was frequently applauded by a loud gee and rattling of assegais on shields from the whole contingent. It was a wonderfully impressive scene, and one which will always remain fresh in my memory. No further advance was made that day, so we camped where we were. Reveille sounded very early, around 3 a.m. the next morning, and we marched to attack Sorayo's kraal. It was most unpleasant going, for above us on our right were hills with the usual cavernous rocks. It was evident that the warriors we'd heard singing their war chant the day before were ensconced in those caves. For the instant the troops got within range, a continuous popping went off from those places. A crack, crack, crack of their guns and rifles echoed and re-echoed among the hills in the still morning air, and made it impossible to detect exactly from where the shots were coming from. Now and again a Zulu was seen in the open, and on one such occasion I saw the man taking deliberate aim at Colonel Glynn, who was standing in an open patch above me. Shouting as loud as I could, I told him to get out of the way before the shot was fired. Before many minutes, bullets were whizzing around in all directions, and one of our natives, who was close by my side, got a bullet in the thigh, breaking the bone. A short distance further on, seeing two officers sheltering behind a rock instead of leading their men, I went to drive them on, and had just got them away, when ping, a bullet came and cut away a branch just at the spot where my head was a second before. This was luck. Before very long, I could hear Major Black's shrill voice in broad Scotch urging his men on, and making his way up to him with supports, I found that he and Commandant Hamilton Brown were in a hot corner close to some caves with hand-to-hand fighting going on. When I was within about 20 or 30 yards of the place, one of their men fell almost at my feet with a terrible assegai wound which had nearly cut him in half, right down the back. The poor fellow was not dead, and although I could see it was only a matter of minutes, my feelings almost led me to try and put him out of his misery with my revolver, but I abstained. I went onto the ridge of the spur of the hill in front of me as fast as I could to see what was on the other side and to assist on Major Black's flank. Eventually, on reaching the foot of a ledge of rocks, where they curved in a horseshoe bend overhanging a deep valley, a somewhat grim sight presented itself. Confronting me, across the bend, was a large open-mouthed cave, apparently capable of holding a good number of men, and hanging below it were several dead Zulus, caught in the monkey rope creepers and bits of bush. They'd evidently been shot and had either fallen out or been thrown out by their comrades when killed. Clambering at once over a big piece of rock, I got rather a rude shock on finding a Zulu sitting in a squat position behind another rock almost at my elbow. His head showed above the rock and his wide open eyes glared at me, but I soon discovered that he was dead. But scarcely had I left this apparition behind than a live Zulu suddenly jumped up from his hiding place and, putting the muzzle of his rifle within a couple of feet of my face, pulled the trigger. But the cap snapped, whereupon he dropped his rifle and made off over the rocks for the cave as hard as he could go. Providence had once again come to my aid, and away I went after him, emptying my revolver at him as we scrambled up. Out of my six shots, only one hit him, but not mortally. I stopped for a second to reload, but finding the wretched thing stuck, I threw it down into the valley below, at the same time turning round and shouting to the officer who I thought was following me to let me have his revolver. But he had remained behind, where I had left him at the start, and all he did was to call out as loud as he could, "Captain Harford is killed." However, I soon put this right. No, he is not. He is very much alive. Before getting up into the cave myself, not caring to run my head into a noose thoughtlessly, I demanded to know if there was anyone else inside, and was assured that there was no one, and as all was quiet, and although I must say I had some slight misgivings, I clambered in. Close to the entrance lay a wounded man with his feet towards me. Although unable to rise, he clutched hold of an assegai that was by his side, but I told him at once to drop it, that I was going to do him no harm, and questioned him as to who was with him in the cave. He stoutly denied that there were any others there. By this time I was getting accustomed to the darkness, and kept on repeating that I knew there were others somewhere in hiding, and that they were telling me lies. At the same time adding, in a tone loud enough to be heard by anyone near, that if they would come out, I would promise on oath that no harm should be done to them, and that I would accompany them myself to the general, who would see that they were well treated. In a short time, this had the desired effect, and presently a head appeared from a hole, another and then another came out from the same spot. All were unharmed and squatted down close to me. I then wanted to know where the others were, but they swore that there was no one else. On getting back to the contingent, one of the men walked up to me and, with the usual salutation of Inkosi, bravely handed me my sword, spurs, and courier bag, all of which had been torn off me in walking through the bush, as well as the discarded revolver. It would have been almost impossible to have found them again, even if a search party had been sent out, but luckily, this good Samaritan had followed carefully in my tracks and picked up the things as they were dropped. Curious to say, in the excitement of the moment, I never felt anything going. Not very long after the men had dispersed, and somewhere around 2 p.m, the headquarters bugle sounded, and I at once rode off to where the general and his staff were located, and received orders to get the contingent together at once and bring them up. Here, the first person I came across was Major Black, 2nd Battalion, 24th Regiment, who, like other officers, was scanning the ground towards Isandhwana with his field glasses and was evidently in a great state of anxiety. I said to him, "What's happening, Major?" And he replied, "The camp has been attacked, and something very serious has occurred." While our men were being formed up, I proceeded to have a look at Isandhwana and the camp myself with my glasses. I could only see two tents standing not very far from the neck, and these looked partially black as scorched by fire, but was unable to see a living creature of any sort. News now began to leak out, and our movements made more sense. While we were fighting at Matiana's, the general had received reports from the mounted men that the camp at Isandhwana was being attacked. Then, after our men had been let loose, further and more serious reports had come in, and finally we were assembled to prepare for an advance on the camp when Lonsdale's message to the general, written on a scrap of paper, "For God's sakes, come, the camp has been taken," was brought in by Hamilton Brown. Both Lonsdale and Hamilton Brown left us at Matiana's, and both apparently found their way to the camp at Isandwana, but Lonsdale evidently got there first, and in a fit of absent-mindedness, he rode straight into the camp, and, as he told me afterwards, got up to where his tent was pitched when he suddenly discovered nothing but Zulus, looting and dressed in soldiers' coats, whereupon he turned round and rode away. Apparently, the apparition of a live white man in their midst, when they felt certain that they had killed everyone, so alarmed them that they let him go unheeded. A marvellous adventure. Of course, when well clear, he rode for dear life to bring the terrible news to the general. It was nearly 4 o'clock, and before being formed up for attack, the general briefly addressed the troops, telling them that the camp had been taken and saying that he relied on us to retake it. When getting within about a mile of the camp, a large body of Zulus were seen disappearing over a hill to the right of it, looking like an enormous mass of ants or swarm of bees, so we were halted for a few minutes to let the artillery send a few shells into them. We saw every shell burst right in the middle of them, but the mass was so dense that whatever gaps were caused by the shot were instantly filled up, and it was impossible to see what damage had been done. Anyone who has handled a swarm of bees would see the simile. It was quite dark when the force reached the now devastated camp. On the right, where I was with the 2nd Battalion, the grass on the undulating ground over which we advanced had been trampled quite flat and smooth by the Zulu army, but no dead were lying about, so without doubt they must have carried off their own casualties. On the left, however, towards the neck, where the 24th and others of our men made their stand, the dead lay thick, and it was a ghastly sight. The greater portion of the Zulu army, which had taken part in the massacre in the camp, we learned afterwards had gone straight off to Kambula, 60 miles away that night, to attack Colonel Evelyn Wood's column the next morning. The night was pitch dark, and the stench, which was mostly from the smashed-up contents of the Royal Army Medical Corps wagon containing all manner of chemicals, was truly awful. As soon as the bivouac had settled down, and by this time the Zulus had begun to light fires and could be seen moving about us on the ridge just across the valley, barring our line of retreat to Rourke's Drift, Lord Chelmsford himself took a look round to see how things were going. On coming across us, he had many questions to ask concerning the contingent, and stayed talking for some time, among other things asking me what I thought the Zulus would do, whether they would attack us or not. And I told him that I felt pretty certain that they would as soon as it was daylight. The visit to my tent, however, proved a blank. Everything had gone, and the same with Lonsdale's tent, which was next to it. But between our tents lay the bodies of two artillerymen, disemboweled and terribly mutilated. Within a few yards of where our wagon had been drawn up, I found the dead bodies of our two drivers, with their faces blackened, and it struck me at the time that they must have done this to themselves in the hope of being able to escape. And on passing the hospital wagon, from whence all the abominable stench came, I came across the body of Surgeon Major Shepherd, the PMO, who in years gone by had been assistant surgeon in the 99th Regiment. He was lying face downwards and had been stabbed in the neck, but his body had not been mutilated. Several times during the night, Major Clary, the Adjutant General, came over and had a talk, and on one of those occasions we were strolling out on the neck when we came across a large tarpaulin rolled up, and being a comfortable-looking seat, both of us at once sat down, but silently rose up again somewhat horrified on feeling that we had sat on something soft and undoubtedly a dead body. Why neither of us thought of unrolling the tarpaulin to ascertain whose body it was, I don't know, except that under the circumstances of the moment, with dead all around one, we had no stomach for curiosity. During the night, one or two officers of the different corps were permitted to go off for a short time in search of food, but as the Zulus had turned out the contents of the wagon, stabbing or smashing up all the tinned articles, and apparently carrying off all the biscuits, little or nothing was found. One officer, however, Lieutenant Newnham Davis of the Buffs, who was with the Mounted Infantry, managed to get a 2-pound tin of corned beef, almost whole, and as we tramped in together to Rourke's Drift the following morning, demolished the lot, never offering me or anyone else even a mouthful. I don't think another officer, non-commissioned officer or private in the whole column would have been guilty of such selfish gluttony. Throughout the night, we could see the intermittent flashes of light from the firing at the Rourke's Drift post, which was only some 3 or 4 miles off in a straight line, though 12 miles by road. Everyone felt very anxious for the fate of the little garrison after what had happened in the camp, and longed for daylight to march to their relief. Everything was perfectly quiet at Rourke's Drift after the column had left, and every officer and man was going about his business as usual. Not a soul suspected that only a dozen miles away, the very men that we had said goodbye and good luck to were either dead or standing back to back in a last, fierce fight with the Zulus. Our garrison consisted of B Company of the 224th under Lieutenant Bromhead, and details which brought the total number of us up to 139. Besides these, we had about 300 men of the Natal native contingent, but they didn't count as they bolted in a body when the fight began. We were all knocking about, and I was making tea for the sick as I was hospital cook at the time. Suddenly, there was a commotion in the camp, and we saw two men galloping towards us from the other side of the river, which was Zululand. The horsemen shouted and were brought across the river, and then we knew what had happened to our comrades. They had been butchered to a man. That was awful enough, but worse was to follow, for we were told that the Zulus were coming straight on from Isandhlwana to attack us. At the same time, a note was received by Lieutenant Bromhead from the column to say that the enemy was coming on and that the post was to be held at all costs. For some little time, we were all stunned. Then, everything changed from perfect quietness to intense excitement and energy. There was a general feeling that the only safe thing was to retire and try and join the troops at Helpmekar. The horsemen had said that the Zulus would be up here in 2 or 3 minutes, but luckily for us they didn't show themselves for more than an hour. Orders were given to strike the camp and make ready to go, and we actually loaded up 2 wagons. Then Mr. Dalton came up and said that if we left the drift, every man was certain to be killed. He'd formerly been a sergeant major in a line regiment and was one of the bravest men that ever lived. Lieutenants Chard and Bromhead held a consultation, short and earnest, and orders were given that we were to get the hospital and storehouse ready for defence, and that we were never to say die or surrender. Not a minute was lost. Lieutenant Bromhead superintended the barricading of the hospital and storehouse and the making of a connection of the defences between the two buildings with walls of mealie bags and wagons. The mealie bags were good, big, heavy things, weighing about 200 pounds each, and during the fight many of them were burst open by assegais and bullets, and the mealies, Indian corn, were thickly spread about the ground. The two officers saw that every soldier was at his post. Then we were ready for the Zulus when they cared to come. They were not long. Just before 4:30, we heard firing behind the conical hill at the back of the drift, and suddenly about 500 or 600 Zulus swept round, coming for us at a run. Instantly, the natives, Kaffirs, who had been very useful in making the barricade of wagons, mealie bags and biscuit boxes around the camp, bolted towards Helpmekar, and what was worse, their officer and a European sergeant went with them. To see them deserting like that was too much for some of us, and we fired after them. The sergeant was struck and killed. 6 of us were stationed in the hospital, with orders to hold it and guard the sick. We were pinned like rats in a hole, because all the doorways except one had been barricaded with mealie bags, and we had done the same with the windows. To talk of hospital and beds gives the idea of a big building, but as a matter of fact, this hospital was a mere little shed or bungalow, divided up into rooms so small that you could hardly swing a bayonet in them. There are about 9 men who could not move, but altogether there are about 30, Most of these, however, could help to defend themselves. As soon as our Kaffirs bolted, it was seen that the fort, as we had first made it, was too big to be held. So Lieutenant Chard instantly reduced the space by having a row of biscuit boxes drawn across the middle, about 4 feet high. This was our inner entrenchment and proved very valuable. The Zulus came on at a wild rush, and although many of them were shot down, they got to within about 50 yards of our south wall of mealie bags and biscuit boxes and wagons. But it was the hospital they assaulted most fiercely. I had charge with a man that we called Old King Cole, of a small room with only one patient in it. Cole kept with me for some time after the fight began, then he said he was not going to stay. He went outside and was instantly killed by the Zulus, so that I was left alone with the patient, a native whose leg was broken and who kept crying out, "Take my bandage off so that I can come." But it was impossible to do anything except fight, and I blazed away as hard as I could. By this time, I was the only defender of my room. Poor old King Cole was lying dead outside, and the helpless patient was crying and groaning near me. The Zulus were swarming around us, and there was an extraordinary rattle as the bullets struck the biscuit boxes and queer thuds as they plumped into the bags of mealies. Then there were the whiz and rip of the assegais, of which I had experience during the Kaffir campaign of 1877 to 1878. We had plenty of ammunition, but we were told to save it, and so we took careful aim at every shot, and hardly a cartridge was wasted. One of my comrades, Private Dunbar, shot no fewer than 9 Zulus, one of them being a chief. From the very first, the enemy had tried to rush the hospital, and at last they managed to set fire to the thick grass which formed the roof. This put us in a terrible plight, because it meant that we were either to be massacred or burnt alive, or get out of the building. Besides, there were helpless sick and wounded, and we couldn't leave them. My own little room communicated with another by means of a frail door like a bedroom door. Fire and dense, choking smoke forced me to get out and go into the other room. It was impossible to take the native patient with me, and I had to leave him to an awful fate. But his death was, at any rate, a merciful one. I heard the Zulus asking him questions, and he tried to tear off his bandages and escape. In the room where I now was, there were 9 sick men, and I was alone to look after them for some time, still firing away with the hospital burning. Suddenly, in the thick smoke, I saw John Williams, and above the din of battle and the cries of the wounded, I heard him shout, "The Zulus are swarming all over the place. They've dragged Joseph Williams out and killed him." John Williams had held the other room with Private William Horrigan for more than an hour, until they had not a cartridge left. The Zulus had then burst in and dragged out Joseph Williams and 2 of the patients and assegaied them. It was only because they were so busy with this slaughtering that John Williams and 2 of the patients were able to knock a hole in the partition and get into the room where I was posted. What were we to do? We were pinned like rats in a hole. Already the Zulus were fiercely trying to burst in through the doorway. The only way of escape was the wall itself, by making a hole big enough for a man to crawl through. But all this time the Zulus were trying to get into the room. Their assegais kept whizzing towards us, and one struck me right in the front of my helmet. I escaped with a scalp wound which did not trouble me much then, although it has often caused me illness since. Only one man at a time could get in at the door. A big Zulu sprang forward and seized my rifle, but I tore it free and, slipping a cartridge in, I shot him point blank. Time after time I wrenched it back, because I had a better grip than they had. All this time, Williams was getting the sick through the hole into the next room, all except one, a soldier of the 24th named Conley, who could not move because of a broken leg. Watching for my chance, I dashed from the doorway, and grabbing Conley, I pulled him after me through the hole. His leg got broken again, but there was no help for it. As we left the room, the Zulus burst in with furious cries of disappointment and rage. Now there was a repetition of the work of holding the doorway, except that I had to stand by a hole instead of a door, while Williams picked away at the far wall to make an opening to escape into the next room. There was more desperate, but almost hopeless fighting as it seemed, but most of the poor fellows were got through the hole. Again, I had to drag Conley through, a terrific task, because he was a very heavy man. We were the last men to leave the hospital after most of the sick and wounded had been carried through, but it was impossible to save a few of them, and they were butchered. Privates William Jones and Robert Jones, during all this time, were doing magnificent work in another ward which faced the hill. They kept at it with bullet and bayonet until 6 of the 7 patients had been removed. They would have got the 7th, Sergeant Maxfield, out safely, but he was delirious with fever, and, although they managed to dress him, he refused to move. Robert Jones made a late rush to try and get him away like the rest, but when he got back into the room, he saw that Maxfield was being stabbed by the Zulus as he lay on his bed. When we got into the inner fort, I took my post at a place where 2 men had been shot. While I was there, another man was shot in the neck, I think by a bullet which came through the space between 2 biscuit boxes that were not quite close together. This was about 6 o'clock in the evening, nearly 2 hours after the opening shot of the battle had been fired. Every now and again, the Zulus would make a rush and go for it and get in. We had to charge them out. By this time, it was dark and the hospital was all in flames, but this gave us a splendid light to fight by. I believe it was this light that saved us. The long night passed, and the day broke. Then we looked around us to see what had happened, and there was not a living soul who was not thankful to find that the Zulus had had enough of it and were disappearing over the hill to the southwest. There was no time to sit down and mope, and there were the sick and wounded as well as the rest to look after. As for our own comrades, we buried them. This was done the day after the fight, not far from the place where they fell and at the foot of the hill. Soon afterwards, the cemetery was walled in and a monument was put in the middle. The lettering was cut on it by a bandsman named Melsop, who used bits of broken bayonets as chisels. He drew a capital picture of the fight. Those who had been killed in action were buried on one side of the cemetery, and those who had died of disease on the other side. At last, the day dawned and the troops began to move off. As we approached the drift and reached the hill overlooking the river and the post, the excitement became intense. All eyes were strained and field glasses raised to see if there was any sign of life in the fort. Then, as we drew nearer, a man was seen on the bared roof of one of the buildings, signaling with a flag, which was hailed with a tremendous cheer from the whole column, as we knew that the garrison had not been wiped out. The general and his staff galloped off at once to the fort, and the troops got in by degrees, the selecting of their camping grounds taking some little time. We were the last to get in, and for some time it was quite impossible to keep the men in hand. They were all round the surroundings of the fort in a second, crowding about the Zulu dead who were lying thick everywhere, partly, no doubt, from curiosity, but I dare say some of them may have been looking out to identify friends or relations, as many of the Natal Kaffirs are refugees from Zululand. As I ate biscuits, I wandered about the fort, looking at the wreckage, which gave the appearance and feeling of devastation after a hurricane. Several of our dead lay just where they had fallen, and one of them, a youngster in the Natal Mounted Police, struck me particularly. To make matters worse, we had a lot of rain, and the interior of the fort became a simple quagmire from the trampling of so many feet. This terrible state of things, living in such slush, caused a lot of sickness from fever and dysentery, which carried off a large number of men and 1 or 2 of the officers. Notwithstanding this, and the knowledge that the fort was overcrowded, Colonel Glynn declined to have any tents pitched outside to relieve matters, being afraid that the Zulus might sweep down on the place again. The officers of the contingent being all mounted, it fell to our lot to perform all the patrolling work, and at dawn every morning while the garrison stood to their arms, we issued out to scour the surrounding country for a mile or two, closely examining the ground everywhere. It kept us in excellent health and spirits, and was most interesting. The landscape all around was simply magnificent, and the scent from the different flowering shrubs and grasses, especially the tambuti grass in the warm atmosphere, was too delicious for anything. I used to long for my gun when a buck jumped up, but alas, my two beautiful weapons, a 12 and an 11 bore from George Gibbs of Bristol, together with every other of my belongings, had been lost in the camp. Isandwana Hill and the neck on which we had slept on the night of the disaster was always in sight. A sharp eye was kept on all the ground in that direction, and for the first week or so, small parties of Zulus could be seen clearly through our glasses, wandering about, searching the place all over, no doubt, for either full or empty cartridges. Several were dressed in white shirts, some of which were undoubtedly my property, as I had had a dozen new ones in my portmanteau. Notwithstanding the fact that some of the enemy were still hanging around in the vicinity, the whole of the men of the garrison were eager to march back to Isandwala and bury the dead, but the authorities considered that too great a risk would be run, so much to the regret of all, the dead were left where they lay. Occasionally I rode out by myself to take a look around, and one afternoon, about a mile from the fort, came across a Bible, and a few feet further on, a silver watch, which I restored to their rightful owner, the Reverend Mr. Smith, when I got back. And very pleased he was to have them in his possession again. The same day, I think it was, I came across the body of a very fine specimen of a Zulu in the skeleton stage, which I took Surgeon Reynolds out to have a look at. He too was impressed with the stature and splendid proportions, and brought away one or two bones of scientific interest, and the soles of the feet, which had become detached and were just like solid pieces of horn. I also took one of the collarbones and the lesser bones of one of the arms, which I intended someday to give to the Durban Museum. Transport riders, one of which told me that he reckoned to clear £300 on his trip, periodically appeared both at Rorke's Drift and Helpmacar when the lines of communication were free from any chance of attack, and proved to be both a blessing and a curse, as they not only brought every sort of article much needed by us all in the shape of clothing and boots and little accessories, but by far the greater portion of their stores consisted of drink. The regular troops, of course, were kept in hand and could only make their purchases under supervision, but with the contingent it was a different matter, and directly those wagons arrived, no work could be got out of them, and it became impossible to keep any state of discipline. All had plenty of money, and they spent it freely. The prices asked for everything were enormous. Boots were from £2 to £5 a pair, £1.25 whiskey, champagne £3, and so on. Nevertheless, wagons were soon emptied. On one particular occasion, a non-commissioned officer of the contingent, an oldish man who had been a grave digger, gave us an anxious time and a lot of trouble, which ended in a rather amusing episode. He'd purchased a whole case of brandy, 12 bottles, and disappeared with it somewhere in the bush, unbeknownst to anyone. For a whole week, search parties, including myself, were out searching every nook and corner to discover his whereabouts, but not a trace could be found of him, until one afternoon, Lieutenant Wainwright walked over to a small hut about half a mile from the camp, which was right out in the open and which several of us, including myself, had visited before and found perfectly empty, with the exception of an iron bedstead with a mattress on it. But on going inside, seeing nothing more than that, he had called out, "Corporal, you come out of this. We know you're hiding somewhere about here." Suddenly, the mattress began to move, and out popped a head from the inside of it, which said, "Aha, it's you, my bold Pippin, is it? All right. I'll come out." Wainwright brought him back none the worse for his debauch and a week in the jungle without food. Such a thing as a scare was unknown to us at Rorke's Drift, though parties of Zulus continued to prowl about in the vicinity long after Isandwana, but on my ride down to the coast I found everywhere still suffering from nerves and most of the streets with their barricades still standing. There was one lager between Helpmacar and Greytown, where nearly a month after Isandwana a night scare took place, when several thousands of rounds of ammunition were expended on what proved in the morning to be nothing but a derelict orcs, which a fool of the century had mistaken for a party of Zulus. I was offered the appointment of second staff officer to the column that Colonel Mansfield Clark was organizing at Port Dumford for the purpose of hunting down Quechuayo. It was a great piece of luck, and fortunately, the colonel had no objection to me going. First of all, we headed over towards St. Lucia Bay, traveling over some beautiful country and coming across lots of game, buck, zebra, buffalo, etc. We had a rifle and a few rounds of ammunition with us, our only armament, but reserved it for use only if we got hard up for food. Otherwise, had we been on a shooting expedition, we could have had some splendid sport. Being still at war, nearly all the kraals we visited in hope of learning something of Quechuayo's whereabouts were absent of men. None but the very old and the women and children remained, and from these neither information or supplies of any sort could be obtained. When we asked for milk, for example, the invariable reply was, "How are we to get milk when our men are all away fighting?" The next day, one of the first kraals we visited belonged to a hunchback Induna, probably, if not for certain, the only born so deformity in Zululand who was looked upon with great reverence by the Zulus. He owed his life to the fact that his birth as a deformity had been predicted by the witch doctors, who had also foretold that he was to become a powerful chief. Consequently, he was not, as is the invariable custom, put out of the way at birth. We were now not far from the kraal of Somkele, and had a most unforgettably adventurous day. The country now was almost treeless, and we rode over nothing but a sea of rolling, grassy hills. We were about to visit a chief almost as powerful as Quechuayo himself, and one who Quechuayo really feared. Stuart and I usually rode together a little distance ahead of the others, and when we were within a mile or so of Somkele's abode, a large party of Zulus appeared, coming towards us over a distant rise, fully armed with assegais and shields, which didn't look at all pleasant. When they got to within a few hundred yards of us, just as they were topping some rising ground, they suddenly discarded their assegais, slipping them under the long grass. Stuart didn't quite notice this, but I did, knowing the trick well. When we met, they carried nothing but their shields, and a couple of Indunas came up to us and explained that they had been sent by Somkele to ask what we were doing in this territory. Stuart then informed them that he was on a mission from the Great Queen and required an interview with Somkele, and that our mission was a peaceful one. Seeing that we were unarmed, I think put them at their ease, and we asked them to conduct us to the kraal. But before going on, we asked them why their men had left their assegais behind in the grass, and told them that we had seen them throwing them away, to which they replied that we must have been mistaken. So we said, "All right, we will take you to the spot." And on getting to the place, there were the assegais, all beautifully hidden. "Now," we said, "how do you account for this?" "Oh," they replied, "we know nothing about it. These must be assegais belonging to the herd boys." "Well," we said, "you must have them all picked up at once before we go any further," and a goodly lot were collected. I shall not forget the scene in a hurry. A roadway led straight through to the top end of the kraal, on either side of which squatted at least 1,000 warriors in full fighting costume. Through these we rode, and as we did so an audible murmur, whether of approval or not I cannot say, ran through their ranks. Behind them, at the end of the road, sat Somkele, with an old shawl of many colours thrown over his shoulders and surrounded by his ministers. Having saluted him, he simply waved his hand at us and said, "Get down." However, on looking round, I saw that no mats had been placed for us, and we mentioned the fact to Stuart. So we said, "When you have provided a place for us, we will get off our horses," and pointed out that the bare ground was not quite the place for a representative of the Great Queen to be asked to take a seat. Royal mats were at once brought out, and we got off our ponies, which were immediately taken away. We were now absolutely in Somkele's hands, to treat us as he wished. It must be remembered that we were still at war with the Zulu nation, so that it was impossible to say what situation might arise. It was a rather delicate matter, starting the subject of the whereabouts of his uncle, but with Stuart's diplomacy, although the interview was a long one, the discussion was carried on throughout in the most amicable manner. However, Somkele was a past master in the art of evading compromising questions, and we utterly failed in getting any information out of him. During this time, one of Somkele's warriors came up to us and asked if any of us had been at Isandwana, and on telling him that I was out at the contingent at the time of the fight, he caught hold of both my hands and shook them firmly in a great state of delight, saying it was a splendid fight. "You fought well, and we fought well," he exclaimed, and then showed me 11 wounds that he had received, bounding off in the greatest ecstasy to show how it all happened. Rushing up towards me, he jumped, fell on his stomach, got up again, rolled over and over, crawled flat, bounded on again and so forth until he came right up to me, his movements being applauded by the warriors squatting in the centre of the kraal with a loud gee. I now had a close look at his wounds. One bullet had gone through his hand, 3 had gone through his shoulder and smashed his shoulder blade, 2 had cut the skin and slightly into the flesh right down the chest and stomach, and 1 had gone clean through the fleshy part of the thigh. The others were mere scratches in comparison with these, but there he was, after about 8 months, as well as ever, and ready for another set to. Could anything more clearly show the splendid spirit in which the Zulus fought us? No animosity, no revengeful feeling, but just sheer love of a good fight, in which the courage of both sides could be tested, and it was evident that the courage of our soldiers was as much appreciated as that of their own. To compensate Somkele for not letting him keep a brandy flask, Stuart presented him with a round metal-backed looking glass, which by the merest chance he happened to have in his pockets. The glass delighted the old chap beyond everything, and at once he held it up close to his face to look at himself and exclaimed, "Ow! Oh, I never knew that I was so ugly." It was very evident that the various expeditions had been following much the same scent, and no doubt their movements, concerning which Quechuayo was kept well informed, led him to take refuge in the forest, where eventually Clark's column succeeded in finding him. A tent was provided for him and his wives, and a guard mounted over it of the 60th Rifles. Having captured the king and thus virtually ended the campaign, the column had to see the completion of the surrendering of arms, demanded and ordered by the government. The column's mission was at an end, and in accordance with orders from headquarters, we proceeded to Maritzburg for dispersal, and a very pleasant march it was, passing over a lovely country.